Today is Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. Today is this is a part 12 Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Eileen Mulady Meekum, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great.
Thanks. Good to hear your voice.
You too. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Last time you told us some amazing stories about Judge Verkamp, V-E-R-K-A-M-P, and that sort of 1991 to 1993 time period. There were a couple events in 1992. I wondered if you could tell us about. One was Danny Ray Horning, and the other one was Hurricane Andrew.
Yeah. In late June of 1992, I just got a text that made that funny sound. My husband and I were park rangers, well, south end of the Grand Canyon. He was a structural fire chief. I was on the summer day shift, and one of the things that we tried to do on our same days off was to leave the canyon, to go somewhere and to really get away from it all, because if you stayed home, you'd get called out inevitably, and we never had any quiet time. And we both loved Arizona. We loved Prescott, and we discovered when we first moved there the year before that there was a yearly rodeo. In fact, the Prescott Rodeo has a claim of being the very first rodeo ever. I don't know if that's true, but that was their claim to fame. Mm. But you couldn't get in. You know, people for years could not get tickets to the rodeo, and if you got tickets, you couldn't find a hotel room. And we certainly tried our first year and our second year, and were unsuccessful. This year, not only did I get a hotel room, I got tickets for it.
Wow.
But the deal that was really huge was it was the 4th of July, and we never got the 4th of July off being in emergency services. And it just happened to fall on our days off. So it was like the trifecta was wonderful. Mm. So we were all excited. And but a week or so before then, it was the evening, I think it was late 26th, 5th, something like that. There was, as it turned out, a wanted man in Arizona. And as I recall from the news stories, that he had been staying in some of the campgrounds in the Flagstaff area, they discovered later on under a pseudonym, and he was wanted for murder in California, the dismemberment murder of somebody and something else. And come to find out that that evening I was like right after work, it was like 5 or 6 o'clock at night, I think it was, and I'd just gotten home, and a bunch of alarms started going off, and we went, whoa, what's this? And then it said, shots fired. And we went, whoa, that's not your usual response. So we all got dressed. And what had happened in, like, the few minutes before that alert went out is, and we know all this now because it's the time has passed, but Danny Ray Horning kidnapped, which is the name of the person, H-O-R-N-I-N-G, kidnapped a family in Flagstaff, Arizona. And they were in a camper-type vehicle. And they drove to the Grand Canyon, and they were at gunpoint. And he stayed in the back of the camper van with the children and told the parents or one of them to go into the store to go buy food or whatever it is they're going to do. And so they went to the store, and two officers, and Donnie Miller and John Piastic, I'll try to remember his name, were the two different patrol cars. And I forget which one was which, but one was driving through the different lines of parked cars because that was a very busy time of night. And a man, trying to be as calm as possible, walked past him and said, "There's a man with a gun holding my family hostage." And he went, "Whoa." And so Donnie called it in and proceeded down there, and he just said, "Just wait here." And so he went up to it, and the guy got out of Danny Ray Horning apparently got out, and the details have escaped me now, but he shot at Donnie, carjacked a woman in a car, I believe, and told her to drive. And Donnie called it in following the car when John Piastic, that was his name, came in one of the entrances as Danny Ray was going out in response to this lights and sirens. Danny Ray shot at him and hit his car and then proceeded down in front of the old visitor center up past the El Pavar entrance down in front of the Bright Angel into West Rim Drive. I don't know quite exactly what happened here, but I don't know if he could get past the gate or got past the gate and couldn't get further, but he parked the car and he ran to the rim, and the hot pursuit was on, and so everybody was called out. They called out the sheriff's department. Everybody was called to get this man. Luckily for us, he left the woman in the car unharmed. So here's a fugitive now by himself, and so we are flooding the area. Unbeknownst to us, he went back behind the responding vehicles along the rim back toward the El Tovar, crossed across the street, and headed into the woods by the Maswick. And he was very clever. I think I learned later on that he took his shoes and socks off and put his socks on over his boots so that you couldn't find a trail, a tread, and took off that way. So now we had a kidnapper, fugitive, man wanted for murder in California in the Grand Canyon. And so all these people came into the area. We had the FBI. We had, it was quite a few different agencies. I think it was like 15 or 16 different agencies. Department of Public Safety, Coconino County Sheriff's Department, the National Park Service, the U.S. Marshals, you name it, they were there.
Wow.
And so they set up a command post, and immediately it was in the next, we didn't find them despite all our efforts. And so the next day, the big command post was set up, and someone was in charge of this whole thing. So it was taken away from Grand Canyon Rangers, and we became part of this much larger incident command.
Okay.
And which is appropriate, and we all agreed with it because this is not something we normally do.
Was that so was it the Park Police that ran the IC for that?
No, I think it was the FBI.
Okay.
I think it was the FBI. And so you all were given specific jobs. And so anybody who had a law enforcement commission was pretty much relieved of their duties, any other duties they had. So I wasn't an EEO counselor. I wasn't a paramedic. I wasn't on a structural fire brigade, if I could help it. They brought in people from the outside. So they contracted with a company in Phoenix to bring paramedics up with their ambulances to take the calls. They had other people come up to be part of the fire department to supplement Kent's thing. I can't remember.
Oh, wow.
But they needed the law enforcement. And then as the days went on, we were working 12-hour days, and they were looking for them. And we were doing building searches. We would have six people on the outside, and six people would go inside with guns drawn looking for them from residence to residence. Anybody see this person? And the thing that irritated us after the third day is they would not close the park.
Mm-hmm.
They did not close the park. They were letting visitors come into the park with this armed fugitive. And I just thought that was wrong, but I wasn't in charge of the world. But until all these other people came up, we had many jobs. So I was still doing paramedic calls and all that kind of stuff. One of the things they did is because he had taken people hostage, is I was the liaison with the FBI hostage rescue team, the HRT. And it was important that they have a feeling for what the environment is that they are going to be dealing with. So my job with these three gentlemen were to take them up in the helicopter, fly over the village, tell them what the different buildings were, take them down to Phantom Ranch, and you know, just give them the lay of the land kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and then it was really very fun for me and for Jerry. Not Jerry Bonner. Yeah, Jerry Bonner, who was the pilot at the time. And because I flew hundreds of missions with Jerry. In fact, he was the first one I ever flew with, and I literally flew hundreds of missions with him. So he was a nice guy. We got along just great. And I would sit in the front of the Bell Long Ranger we had at the time. We didn't have the MD-900 at the time. So it was a Bell Long Ranger. And so the HRT people were in the back. And I think we were flying not just these, but others. So we, it was like three or four different flights. We'd have three people in the back, seat belted in. And we'd fly over the village, which is actually pretty cool because you're not allowed to fly over the village unless it's an emergency.
Mm.
You go through the Dragon Corridor, you go through the Hopi area. And so so it really was very interesting for me to see everything and point everything out to them. And then Jerry had this great, we went over to just past West Rim and to drop down to down to Phantom Ranch to show them that. And so the first time Jerry did it, and he goes, welcome to, and he looked at me and he smiled and I knew what he was going to do. And he said, welcome to the Grand Canyon. And as soon as we went off the Kaibab limestone, he went straight down, straight down along the wall. It was amazing. Those guys screamed back at the helicopter. Ah! It was like they were crashing. And he just beat probably 60, 70 miles an hour right down to the Tonto platform.
Wow.
And then on off over. And it really, it was like a falling elevator. You became weightless for a second. It was really amazing. And we did this every single time, and we just loved it. And the guys, everybody always screamed in the back seat. But maybe I shouldn't tell that story, but it's too late now.
You know,
and
what?
Jerry
what it would be, could you tell me more Jerry stories?
Oh, Jerry's wonderful.
What do you look like? What do you sound like?
Jerry
tall,
was,
short?
He's about my height, about 5'7".
Okay.
About the same height. He had white hair and a white mustache, and he was, when I first went to the Grand Canyon, he was the backup pilot for the contract helicopter for the Grand Canyon, and that was from Papillon Helicopters, P-A-P-I-L-L-O-N, that ran tours out of Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry had been a Vietnam War pilot, and so he was very, very experienced. And he only flew, I think, 2 days a week for the Grand Canyon contract because there was another Bob Boomer who did it full time. And so on Bob Boomer's days off, it's amazing, his name is coming back to me, Jerry Bonner would be the backup pilot. So I'm at the Grand Canyon a very short amount of time, and it was an early morning call, and they said there's a report of an impaled object in someone's eye at Havasu Falls.
Mm.
And I said, oh, this sounds awful. It said, report to the helibase. And I said, yeah. So it was like a very quiet, I want to say a Sunday morning. And I go up there, and the pilot walks up to me, and we're in our flight suits and getting ready to get the briefing and stuff. And he says, I'm Jerry. And I said, hi, I'm Nancy. And I said, I just want to let you know this is my first flight here at Grand Canyon. I'm a new ranger here. And he goes, well, it's my first flight, too. And I went, what? He goes, no. He says, this is my first flight doing the contract for Grand Canyon.
Huh.
Because I fly tours all the time, and I know where everything is, but this is the first time he's the backup pilot.
Oh, cool.
And I thought, well, that's really cool. So we sort of bonded on that. And there's what we call intership communications, ISC. So we talk to each other as we fly. The cool thing about the helicopter before a lot more rules and regulations came and extra people, is I sat in the front next to the pilot, and there's a window in front of you, of course, but what most people don't realize is there's a window at the bottom of your feet.
Hmm.
So you can look through your feet and see what's below you as well. And so my job, and we talked about this, because I had done all the helicopter training you're supposed to do, and I've flown a helicopter before, but I wanted to be on the same page as Jerry. So I'm always looking around, and I'd say, aircraft 2 o'clock high, or another helicopter 8 o'clock low, and so you would be an extra set of eyes for him.
Cool.
You know, and so we would do that. So we flew that first flight, and we came to, and it, I don't know if you've been there, where Havasu Falls into the Colorado River is the black walls of the Zoroaster granite, I believe. The big black walls?
Yeah, no, not there. It's all limestone. It'd be
okay,
more off, at the river, it's more of limestone.
Okay,
but
whatever it is, they're big, steep walls.
Yeah, they're big, steep walls, yeah.
Big, steep walls, and it's flowing down into the Colorado River, and the big, steep walls, it's not like there's a platform there. So So Jerry does this most incredible job of doing a corkscrew circle down and down and down, because there's just no way that you, with the turbulence of the falls coming into the Colorado River and the Colorado River's air turbine is coming up, that you could just, you just can't zoom down, and because we had to land on a shelf downstream of where the river Havasu was going into the Grand Canyon, with his nose up against the wall and the tail out over the Colorado River.
Wow.
That's how dangerous this was. So he came in and we corkscrewed down, and he landed on this shelf. And I got out, and he goes, check out what it is. So I got out, and I walked between the nose, the PTOC point at the front of the helicopter, and then walk along the wall and go up to this group of people. And it's part of a river raft group, and they wanted out of the Grand Canyon. I said, well, where's the person with the impaled object in the eyes? And the river guide takes me away aside and says, well, that's not really the call. And I said, what is it? And he says, well, he was really embarrassed. And he said, well, this person is a very famous person. She is a Kennedy of the Kennedy family. And you might recognize that actress over there, which was, what did she play? Murphy Brown on TV. What was her name? Anyway, some actress over there.
Okay.
And so some famous people. And I said, okay, well, what about the impaled object in the eye? And he goes, well, they did a day hike up to Havasu, and when they came down to the river trip, she stubbed her toes, and now they hurt, and she wants out. I said, excuse me? And I said, hang on. And I went back to Jerry, and I said, this is my first flight, and it turns out not to be impaled object. She stubbed her toes, and she wants out. And he was the most perfect person. He goes, get her and put her in the helicopter, and we will leave. I said, okay. So I went back and I got everybody's name. I got the name of the river guide, and I did all this stuff. She wanted to bring her luggage? No. She wanted to bring her husband? Yes. Bring your husband, leave the luggage, get in the helicopter, put your seatbelts on. That one moment that Jerry gave me was the most professional moment I've ever seen anybody do.
Hmm.
You didn't roll your eyes. You didn't say, what? You didn't do anything. Let's just get our job. Let's just do it and move on. And I said, okay. So we got him in. We corkscrewed out again. We came out, and I evaluated her first up toes, and I called in to Albert De La Garza, who was the Albert D.E., space L-A-G-A-R-Z-A, who was the backcountry star coordinator for the day. And I said, you need to meet us at the helibase. I have a stable BLS patient, and I need to give you a report. And so he met me at the helibase, and he put him in the back of his car to take him there. And he says, I thought this was an impaled object in the eye. And I said, no, and I explained what it was. And as a result of that call, he went in and wrote them both tickets because apparently they pressured the river guide into making that radio call to an airliner that went to the SAR Center, that went to the Grand Canyon to get out.
Huh.
I mean, it was a very complex thing. They both got citations. They both were sent a bill for the helicopter, and that river runner lost his job, and the company was put on notice that they could not be influenced by influential people. For this is a dangerous job, and we are risking our lives to come rescue people.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that was my first flight in the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
I know, stubbed toes. But Jerry was so incredibly professional, and he laughed and he smiled, and he knew what he was doing. And I'd asked him if he'd ever, because we went through crash training together, where we went to a pool in Tucson, and we were put in a contraption and dumped in the pool, and then we waited until we counted to 10, because if you came up too soon, if the rotors were still turning, it would decapitate you.
Hmm.
So we got all wet in our flight suits, and we talked about this, and we did short-haul training, and he would zoom us around from pile to pile to train us, and we knew how dangerous it was, but we were kindred spirits in understanding that we were there for helping people. And I asked him if he had ever crashed, and he says, never in Vietnam, but I came back, and he was working for some company, and there was a line across somewhere that nobody had ever marked to put those colorful balls on.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too far off the ground, and he went and it got between the skids and the belly of the aircraft, and he just flipped, it just stopped him short, and he flipped right up over onto the top of the helicopter, boom, and he walked away from it.
Wow.
But many helicopters have cutters on the front, big cutters that are sitting on the bubble, that if there's a line you don't see, that hopefully it eventually comes to those cutters and is snapped.
Hmm.
And a friend of mine, Nancy Hagerman Blomquist Sumner, she had that happen to her when she was flying out of Page for as a flight nurse one time.
Hmm.
And when they landed, she walked away and never flew again. It's a scary thing to almost crash like that.
Yeah, I bet.
Let's see, what else about Jerry Bonner?
So did he stay flying for the park just on the 2 days a week basis?
No. What happened is eventually Bob Boomer got a contract. When his contract was up with Papillon, he moved on to become a pilot for another company, and that put out fires. And when you have a fire, and you're doing water bucket drops by helicopter, you have this great big orange reservoirs that you set up and you fill with water. The helicopter comes in, dunks the bucket down, fills with water, goes up. It's like an artificial reservoir, and then goes and dumps it on the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, Bob Boomer, after one bucket drop, started to raise up, and the bucket got caught on something, and before he could release the bucket, and usually there's a way to release the line, it pulled him down and killed him.
Oh, wow.
So he left and was killed later on, and then Jerry became the full-time pilot, and then we had the Kiwi. We had many, many different pilots and stuff, but Tom Caldwell later was a pilot, and he was killed in a crash between Flight for Life out of Flagstaff Medical Center and the park helicopter going in, and that was just awful. Killed a park ranger and met paramedic, and it was just awful. But that was later on in the,
yeah.
I think it was 2000 or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Jerry. One time we were at a Pima Point rescue, and he was taking us and equipment down to a man who decided he didn't want to live anymore, and he drove his car a la Thelma and Louise off of Pima Point. He had HIV. He was HIV positive, and he didn't want to die of AIDS, so he drove off. He rented a car, and he drove off the Grand Canyon. And so because our society doesn't leave dead people in cars, we go down and bring the remains back up. And before they had SkyTrain helicopters, heavy-lift helicopters that could lift cars out of places like the Grand Canyon, I was told by one of the older rangers that when cars would go off the canyon, because they've been doing that for decades, they would go down and spray paint them the color of the rocks.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we were coming out at the end of a long day of bringing the remains out. We had to use all of our firefighting tools to extricate them from the car. So I was one of the last to come out, and I was below the helicopter that Jerry was flying. And thank goodness we were over the Grand Canyon and not over the Pima Point parking lot, because something happened. A downdraft hit the helicopter, and the helicopter fell. The helicopter, we estimate later on, fell 60 feet, just fell, like
wow.
A grand piano. And I was underneath it. And I saw the rope as I began to fall. The helicopter was falling faster than I was because the rope came down in front of my face. I could see it make this big loop below me. And I went, whoa. And I'm looking up at the helicopter coming at me. And then Jerry was able to regain control. And then he zipped back up, and then I was yanked back up in the air. And so it was very, at the time, I was not scared. At the time, I had a knife to pull. If I was close to the ground, I was going to cut the line so I wouldn't be dragged by the helicopter across it. I immediately went into self-rescue mode,
mm-hmm.
What I was going to do on all this stuff. When I landed on, when they dropped me off the payment, and so what they do when you're on short haul is they lure you to the payment, you unhook your carabiners, you walk away, you top on your head if you're okay. And as I walked over this, I said, people just came up and said, because people were watching this, watching the helicopter fall with me below, and it says, are you okay? And some people gave me hugs, and they said, oh, my God, that must have been terrifying. And I said, well, to be honest with you, it was kind of exciting. I didn't think about it other than being ready to disconnect.
Right.
But if it had happened over the parking lot, I would have been splatted.
Yeah, because you'd have dropped right to the ground.
Right, at 60 miles an hour, right into the ground.
Yeah.
With a helicopter splatting on top.
Coming on top, yeah.
Yeah. But it did not, and telling the story right now, I never felt like I was going to die. I never felt like I was in fear of my life. I was just in do it mode.
Yeah.
You know, we had a compressor failure one time taking off, and we were taking off on the ground, and suddenly the compressor failed, and we slammed back into the ground right at the helibase. If we'd been more than like 10 feet off the ground, we probably would have been injured pretty badly. But as it was, we split the skids, and that was it.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, there's a risk to what we do, and that's why when a helicopter goes somewhere, it's not light and fun. And, I mean, you're supposed to take it seriously, but if you take yourself seriously as a part of all of this, you can never do it.
Right.
I loved flying. I loved being in the helicopter. I loved short haul, being outside the helicopter, being zoomed from place to place at 60 miles an hour. It was a blast. I have no fear of heights, so it was a blast.
Yeah, yeah.
Jerry later left and flew for CDF, which is now Cal Fire, and I can't tell you what year it was, but this was after I left the Grand Canyon. I found out he didn't report for duty, and they went over to his room, and he had died in the night of a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but he was a good guy, really good guy.
Yeah. So Jerry's got the three...
Yeah, we've got the hostage rescue team.
Yeah, the HRT people from the FBI in the back of the helicopter, and they're all screaming as you're heading down.
So
we're heading off to Phantom Ranch to show them that lay of the land down there?
Right. Okay. Right. And so they got a feel for where everything was, what the Tonto platform was, where South Kaibab Trail and Hans and all that stuff. So we did this orientation, and then there was an incident command center, and everybody would come in. So they had brought in everything you would be for a Type 1 fire. So there was somebody come in to cook and provide meals and showers and shelters. And I believe the school was part of it, because I remember going into a big long room and they sitting with Karen Schinkel and Jerry Schinkel and talking about everything that was going on and sitting down and getting a sandwich or something from the mess. And so I still reported to Ranger Operations, and I still was their liaison. But there were, I believe, over by the end of the week, and this was, you know, a week going on now, there were over 500 extra law enforcement officers in the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
I believe it was 500. And they found where he had been hiding. They found that he had been in the Desert Youth Search and Rescue cache, eating the MREs and the meals ready to eat and the supplies in there. They found later on where he'd been somewhere in a horse barn. And so he was still in the Grand Canyon. Every couple of days they'd find evidence, and they had set up checkpoints. And I remember one day I had a checkpoint at the intersection of Center Road and East Rim Drive toward Desert View. And it was hot. You know, it's like the 1st of July or something, and it's hot. And Gary Lang, who was the local Department of Public Safety in California, they'd call them chippies, California Highway Patrol. But the Highway Patrol officer, I remember him specifically driving up, and because we worked together on a lot of calls together, and he goes, you look hot. And I said, I am hot. And he goes, look what I got. And he opened up the trunk of his patrol car, gave me ice cold water.
Wow.
I'll always remember Gary Lang for that. And to digress for a minute, I went on a call that Gary called us out for during the day, and he had been coming up Highway 64 into the canyon, and this VW van was going in the other direction, and it was all over the road. And he thought, geez, so he turned around to pull him over, and before he could do that, they crashed into a tree.
Hmm.
So they called us out for medical, and I got to, it was one of the few times I got to use a window punch to go into the car, and this lady's femur was broken so badly, it was half the size because the bones slid against next to each other, and we had to extricate. But Gary was the officer on that, and he goes, you know, I always remember saying that this road is so dangerous. They let them go 65 on this road, and it narrows down to one lane, and I drive straddling the fog line. And I said, isn't that illegal? He goes, no. He says, the fog line is just to guide you there. He says, people swerve across the line all the time because they're looking at maps. And these ladies in this VW van were reaching down for a cassette tape or something.
Oh, wow.
And just came off the road. And so he taught me an important lesson about staying away from the center line. And not long after he retired, and I think he retired because of this, he had leukemia or a cancer, and he passed away. And that's why you see a sign, one of those volunteer signs as you go in the Grand Canyon, so for Gary Lang.
Oh, yeah.
He was the DPS officer for 10 years, 18 years when I was there.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so the DPS was there and all these people were there. And the Department of Public Safety, when they want to look good, they wear these flat hats with these gold braid around the brim and these, it makes a V upon the front, and they have their shirts with their stripes on them, long sleeve shirts with their gold striping and everything. And they have these royal blue ties that they wear against their tan uniform. So for formal occasions, they looked really good. So we were working Annie Rehorning, and I was in my turnouts, I was in my flight suit because I was still working with the, you know, the helicopter and the flight stuff. So I wasn't in uniform, but I had my body armor underneath, and I had shoulder holster pistol, 9mm, and my boots and everything else. And I was still, we still hadn't got everybody in place. And I remember we got a call for a man down the Bright Angel Trail. It was 9 o'clock on the Saturday morning, as I recall, for a man having a chest pain. So I drove to the rim and I put on my 35-pound pack and grabbed oxygen, and I started to run down the trail, and somebody was behind me with the ambulance. They stopped. They grabbed the heart monitor and the med bags. We all had our equipment. So we're running down the trail, and luckily he was only about a mile down the trail. So running down the trail. And I got to tell you about running around down the trail in the summertime. That those mules that go up and down those trails, they pee on the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And that pee sits there like a puddle on the trail. And if you're walking, you know how it steps down and steps down and steps down. When you're walking, you can walk around it. If you're running, you can't do that. It's like a steeplechase. So I'm running from water bar to water bar, and every now and then you just put a foot right into the middle of hot pee and just splashes up your leg. It's just awful. But I'm running down the trail trying to avoid the mule pee and droppings, and finally come to this guy, and I'm talking to the EMT on scene, and I'm talking to the guy, and I am hot. So I am in front of everybody unzipping my flight suit and taking my body armor off, because you're going to have to start an IV on me in a minute. But I have a shirt on underneath it. It has a bad shirt and everything on me. And so it turns out he was having a heart attack. He was having a myocardial infarction, so we started an IV, we had him on the heart monitor, gave him medications, and we don't want somebody who's having a heart attack to exert themselves anymore, because that puts more strain on the heart and it can make the heart attack worse, the damage worse. We weren't far enough down to use the LZ for a mile and a half house, and it was too dangerous. We were too close to the top, so I asked for a litter team, and we had so many extra people here that these DPS officers said that they would bring the litter down. So they bring the litter and they put the wheel underneath it, and it's a big long metal bed like contraption, and they're bringing it down the trail. And I'll never forget, as I turned and looked up the trail at these DPS officers who came, and the first one I saw was in his class A's with a tie, flat hat, long sleeve shirts with his gold braid, and I just went, whoa, this is like the most formal, I've ever been on a
litter carry ever.
Oh, but I mean, in his flat, and he's just dripping sweat and left, and so I just, whatever. So we got the guy up there, we got him up to the top, stabilized at the clinic, flown the Flagstaff Medical Center. But we all worked together there. We had lots and lots of help, and I said, this is the way it needs to be all the time. And eventually we got the paramedics out of Phoenix to come take some of the village calls, because I stayed with the star calls and things like that. Well, inevitably, as it turned out, he was still in the Grand Canyon, despite the fact that we're crawling on top of RVs. We've got mirrors, and we're looking underneath cars. We're talking to people. We're looking for this man. We have these checkpoints everywhere. We still can't find him, and he's still somewhere because we keep finding evidence of him somewhere. So the inevitable cancellation of all Lieu days happen. Lieu, L-I-E-U, means days off. That means Kent and I are not going to the Prescott Rodeo.
Ooh.
Despite the fact that we have a hotel, we have tickets, and we have the days off. And I half-heartedly said, when I came out of Ranger Operations, and I just said to somebody standing there, if he walks out of the woods with his hands up, I'm just going to shoot him. And they knew I was kidding, and I was mostly kidding at the moment, but I just was, you know, because that was something you looked forward to, and it didn't happen. So as it turns out, he eventually did escape from the Grand Canyon. He hijacked a car with two women in it, and he sat in the back seat, and he had a gun on them at all times. And whatever disguise he used, he got past three checkpoints of people.
Right, I just found that so fascinating that he was able to sit in the back of the vehicle and just kind of go.
Yeah, and, you know, and they said he's my brother, and he basically they said, if you make it sound like I don't belong to you guys, I'm going to shoot and kill you. So there you have it.
Right.
So eventually he got to somewhere south of Flagstaff, and he tied them to a tree, the two ladies, tied them to a tree, took off more in his car, ended up down in, I think it was it Prescott? What is the town? Starts with an S. Between the Flagstaff and Prescott. Not Oakdale. Anyway, he was somewhere, and he was hiding
Sedona?
Underneath.
No.
No, not that far down. But he, I say Swale Meadows, but I don't think that was it. Anyway, he was found hiding underneath somebody's house, their deck, and the guy called 911, and I said, I think you've got your guy here. So they surrounded the house, let the dogs in, and they captured him finally. And to my knowledge, he went back to California. He was convicted of murder and was killed in prison by another prisoner. But that was Danny Ray Horning.
Yeah, quite the adventure throughout the entire park. And it is interesting what actually closes a park. What closes a park like Grand Canyon? COVID. Closed the park. But it's a rare day on the planet.
And we were upset because, number one, he did inevitably take hostages, and I believe those ladies did sue the National Park Service successfully for endangering them by not closing the park.
Oh, interesting.
Allowing them to be captured.
Hmm.
We not only had to take our time to look for this guy and take care of the residents in the park, which is about 1,500 to 2,000. Now we had 50,000 people a day that we had to take of two. So it just was an overwhelming stupidity for them to not close the park. You know, it just was not good. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can say about it. Yeah. I think that's
okay.
Stoneman Lake. Stoneman Lake is where he was captured.
Ah, okay.
I knew it started with an S. I just couldn't think of the name of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
South of Flagstaff. But it's interesting because in the business, people say, oh, you want to have a really good call. Or if you took care of somebody and their leg was amputated and you put on a tourniquet and you got both parts in and all that kind of stuff. If people say, boy, that was a really good call, they would be appalled because we're using good call in that we got to use our skills.
Right.
That it was a challenge to us and so it was a good call for us. But people might think that is not a good thing. Why are you saying that's a good call when they were hurt so badly?
Right. It was a terrible accident, but you got to use the skills you had to save someone's life, and that's a good call. That's a good skill set.
Yeah, but you have to be careful about saying things like that, not only with the public around, but on the radio. Because if you're standing in line at the cafeteria at Maswick Lodge to get lunch and you say something over, which is one of the reasons we use 10 codes, for instance. So if you find a dead body, which we find dead bodies in the Grand Canyon, you don't say, okay, we've got a dead body over here. That's just not something you want the public to hear. So we say we have a 1099 or 1155 or a 901. There's different codes to use if you have a deceased person so that people don't hear these kinds of things. For the most part, we try to use plain text speak so there, nobody misunderstands you. But there was a very interesting night, and I am segueing into this story because it has merit. I was working night shift in the wintertime, and it was very cold. And there was only two of us, myself and Dave. And so we had all of the South Rim to patrol. There was no snow, but it was one of those 12-degree kind of nights. Hmm. And so I was driving 10 o'clock at nighttime, going out East Rim Drive, and I see in the pullouts and the overlooks a car. And then I see a woman in leotards lying against the windshield with her feet along the hood of the car. And I said, that is really unusual. Hmm. 12 degrees outside. What's wrong with this picture? So I remember I had a Ford Bronco. It was just like the one O.J. Simpson had, but it was a National Park Service. But it was an older model Ford Bronco,
right,
very high off the ground. And so I pulled up, and I called into dispatch, and I said, dispatch, I have a little Toyota pickup truck, white, first overlook, East Rim Drive, gave her the plate, and I didn't leave my V of my car door. So I stood up on the car, so I was, like, much higher than they were, and looking over the roof of my Bronco, and I had gloves on because it's 12 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. And I have the car door open, and the lady looks up, you know, because I have my lights. I lit them up, as we said, so I've got my blue and my red and my yellow lights going, and she gets off, and she goes to one side of the car, and then the car driver doors open, and the man comes out of the car, and he starts to walk, make a wide arc into the street, and she starts to make a wide arc to the left. And I said, get back to your car, get back to the, you know, and so I'm giving them commands, and they're complying. So the thing that's unusual is none of this fit the picture. And so they go back to the car, and I'm still waiting, and I said, I want you to sit on the ground, I want you to sit on your hands. And they did it, and I thought, wow, these are really compliant people, so they must be no big deal. I remember specifically the dispatcher, Jules, and it was the first time she ever got a felony hit back, because she takes that plate, she puts it in the computer. The computer says, is this car wanted or not? If it's a misdemeanor, you say, later on you say, yeah, you have a misdemeanor warrant for this car, and it's not a big deal. If it's a felony warrant, you're supposed to say 1035 Frank, and that tells me that I have a felon in front of me, and to be aware they could be dangerous, armed, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the first turn 1035 Frank she ever had, and so she didn't say 1035 Frank over the radio. She goes, you have a felony warrant on this vehicle. So now not only do I hear it, but the bad guys hear it, and that's the whole point of using the 10 code.
Right.
So I immediately pull my gun out, and I pointed at them, and I said, you guys, just stay where you are. There's a felony warrant, and we're going to clear this up and find out exactly what it is. And I said, I'm sorry if you're cold, but you're just going to have to wait there. And they continued to be compliant. I later found out they were stoned.
Hmm.
You know, they were high, so that's why they were so compliant.
Hmm.
But they later told me on, I said, were you trying to circle around to hurt me? And they said, no, not really, get away. But the not really was, you know, a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about the whole thing is we qualify. I'm really diverging now. We go out to a range, and we qualify with our firearms, whether it's our M16 rifle, if it's our shotgun, if it's our pistol. Mine's at that time was a 9mm 6-hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just qualified a couple days before. And after I did my qualification, says, wait a minute, I want to do it again with my gloves on, because I'm on night shift and it's wintertime, and I don't want to take my gloves off and do it.
Right.
So I did it again, and I qualified with my gloves on. I said, good. So I knew at that moment that I could pull the trigger and do what I needed to do without taking my gloves off, because you want to pass at the range so you don't do it with your gloves on. so you get your score, so you pass every time.
Right.
So I wanted to do it with my gloves on to make sure I could still pass, and I did.
Hmm.
And so I knew at that moment that if I had to use my weapon, I did.
Right.
And so my backup came. Turns out it was a stolen vehicle. We arrested the two. Dave took them back to the holding facility until I could come. And then he called out a couple more Rangers because it was just the two of us on one to take them to jail. It turns out that this vehicle was a brand new vehicle that was stolen from the VA in Fresno, California.
Hmm.
And the story we got eventually was that he went to run inside to show his friends at the VA his new car, and he left the engine running. When he came out, it was gone.
It was gone.
That car was used to burglarize cars throughout California all the way to Searchlight. It was headed into Arizona.
Wow.
And it was an open-bed pickup truck. So my job, because I wasn't doing the jail run, is I took it to the fire station, pulled out the ambulance, brought it in there where it was somewhat warm, and I had to inventory all of the stolen objects in the back of the car, the truck. Bowling balls. What bowling? Who steals a bowling ball? You know, all you name it. It was like 50 different things, and I had to itemize them all, write down serial numbers. And I was there till 6 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
On that. And people don't see that this is part of our job, that we do all of that.
Right.
But you're by yourself. You're pulling people over because you're not supposed to be camping out of bounds, and that's what my probable cause was and my reasonable suspicion for contacting them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got a stolen car report back, and then we got the two people who were wanted felons, and so they were taken back too, and then all this kind of stuff. And you're one person doing all of this stuff, so you do everything you can to stay safe. Had they circled around me, would I have shot them? Absolutely not. I would have gotten the car and gotten in reverse and gotten out of there and waited for help.
Right. Well, this is interesting. I was talking with someone the other day in law enforcement, works for the BLM, and they were saying it gets to the point now where sometimes if they see something that doesn't look right, and they know they have no backup or backup is a long time away, they just keep right on going.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, you talk about seeing the DPS coming down the trail, you know, yeah, there they are in uniforms, which, you know, really not quite appropriate for what they're doing, but you have the help. And in this case, where with these two felons, you didn't have your backup. Dave was a ways away. Without the appropriate force, you really put the employees in a higher risk of danger.
It does. One of the things I always used to do, and I don't know if other people do it, and I did talk to other people, and I didn't get the impression that they did, is I was always going through scenarios. Okay, what if that car did this? And what if somebody did this? I was always thinking about my reaction to things and the consequences of my actions. And I might have told this story, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating it, but when I was in Death Valley one time, I was the only ranger on for Million Acres.
Right.
And I saw a flickering light in the sand dunes, and I drove down with my lights off, and I saw a crowd of at least 20 people who had an illegal bonfire in the sand dunes.
Right.
And I watched them for a couple minutes. Nobody was shooting anything, and I just backed out, and I left.
Right.
And cleaned it up the next day. What am I going to do? Yeah, it was illegal. There's 20 against one. That's stupid.
Right.
Am I going to shoot them all? No.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. So you have to kind of have your wits about you about when to know what you can do and when to know when it's time to, you know, hold them and when it's time to fold them.
And I have to tell you, there is a certain amount of pride in being, and I say this kiddingly, the Lone Ranger, to being in the vehicle by yourself, being able to handle things by yourself, and not having backup or backup is a ways away. To be that competent, to know what decisions to make or what decisions not to make,
right,
made me love that job because it was a job where I thought through things and I thought through the law and I thought about the resources. And I remember stopping a guy who was out of bounds camping and he had all these feathers on the front of his vehicle. And I knew it was a violation of the Lacey Act. And
right.
I knew all these other things. So if I needed a reason to stop this guy, I could.
Hmm.
And one of the things I'm reading in the papers now is they don't want people to do vehicle stops anymore because it leads to shooting of people or, you know, all this kind of stuff. But bad people tend to do bad things, everything. I stopped some people at the Grand Canyon who were driving into the market one day, didn't have a gas cap, but instead have a rag stuck in the gas tank, half in, half out. Well, that's like a driving Molotov cocktail. So I pulled them over and stopped, and I said, hey, you got a rag here? Yeah, we don't have this. As it turns out, they had a stolen, it was a stolen car.
Oh, wow.
And they were all gangbangers out of Phoenix, and we arrested them all. But I would not have done that had they not, you know, not had a blinker work or didn't have backup lights or didn't do that. These trivial little things allow us to step it up to get the bad guys that maybe we wouldn't otherwise get. And I was just reading yesterday, there is a call to not do those things. And I guess it's okay to let people get away with more things than they would otherwise, but that would make us responsive and not preventative, I guess. So that's a whole other topic to talk about sometime.
Yeah.
But if you do it judiciously, and like the guy with all the feathers, I said, you know what? I'm going to take these feathers and put them in the woods. I'm going to write you a ticket for out of bounds camping. I'm not going to write you a ticket for having no registration, but I'm going to write you a thing that you can mail in. And then I let him go, and he thanked me for not taking him off to jail for these 5 violations.
Right. Which is a big deal. I mean, that Lacey Act, there's a lot to that.
And,
so.
And if you take, I always look for as much as I can get against somebody, and it may sound cruel, but that way when I let them off with just one or two things, they actually thank me.
Right.
And I also educate them about all the things they're doing wrong.
Right.
And I've said before, the only things I really used to write for were parking in a disabled or handicapped parking, as we called it back then. And no insurance, because if they hit somebody, that person has no recourse for getting their car fixed, for instance, the person they hit.
Right, right.
So
that's right. That's
anyway.
Right. Anyway. Yeah.
But that was my personal philosophy on things.
Cool. Okay.
So do you want to, when we talk next time, talk about Hurricane Andrew?
Yeah, because we're probably going to talk about that for a while, and we've been talking for a little over 50 minutes, so. So we would spend the next 30 minutes talking about Andrew at least.
I think so.
So maybe this is a good time to put a comma here in this interview series and wrap up part 12. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview before
Not
we wrap it up?
Not this interview, but we talked last time about Judge Burkamp.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say that, and this is a plug, but I wrote 2 books, which your wonderful wife, Hazel Clark, and Vishnu Temple Press published. And they're called Park Ranger and Park Ranger Sequel. And I was fortunate enough, for instance, to get the author Tony Hillerman to write a blurb for the cover of the book on my second book, Park Ranger Sequel. But also Judge Stephen L. Verkamp also wrote a blurb on the book. And it said, Nancy Melody Meekum's startling stories of crime investigation, life-saving medical emergencies, and death-defying rescues against the backdrop of our nation's most spectacular parklands, portray the skill and nerve of our little-known National Park Service force. Nancy's cool, lucid words jump off the pages and engage the reader with nonstop energy. Her intelligence and matter-of-fact telling of her tales of danger, death, and deliverance pack a wallop. The reason I wanted to say this is I spent a lot of time talking about how Judge Verkamp was really upset at protection rangers because of some of the hijinks they would do.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, in addition to protecting the resources, his eyes was opened with all the things that we brought to him. When he read my book and saw all the things that we had to deal with, all the things that I've given you up to this point, you know, people spitting in your face or, you know, no matter what it was, trying to kill you or hit you or doing all that kind of stuff, he realized that we did a lot more than just parked outside of the pub waiting for drunks.
Right.
And it
right.
turned him around, and he actually thanked me for the 2 books.
Nice.
For opening his eyes. So it's important, I think, that people get beyond the duty belt.
Right.
You know, and I think I told you this, that the duty belt that Kathy and I took off our duty belt and our boots and our body armor, and it was 20 pounds that we took off in weight that we wore every day.
Yeah.
But but that's what you need to protect yourself. You need a baton, a collapsible baton. You need sets of handcuffs. You need gloves. You need OC spray, which is oleoresin capsaicin. We didn't use mace. We, you know, you had keys and you had a radio and you had all kinds of things. And so That's my thought.
It's a lot of heavy stuff there. I mean, just thinking about duty belts, and if you're packing a Colt 45 instead of a Sig Sauer 9mm, there's weight there, and how many clips are you carrying? And it just goes, the weight goes up and up and up.
It does. Yeah, we went from speed loaners with I had my 38 and my 357 to magazine holders for my Sig Sauers, and we always carried extras of those. So it was a very professional job that I felt that I brought to the table, but you needed the equipment to do it right.
Right.
The only thing I stopped doing after a while is our body armor, which was made of Kevlar, had a plate in the front because knives could go through plates, could go through Kevlar, interestingly enough, and that plate was just so heavy and hot, I eventually took the plate out.
Yeah.
But that was the concession.
Yeah.
But anyway,
wonderful.
I just wanted to add that thing about Judge Verkamp.
Thank you for doing that. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no, that's after talking about Judge Verkamp in part 11, it's a really nice tribute that he paid to you. It seemed like a wonderful two-way street there to work for him as the magistrate at the park.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Nancy. Well, with that, this will conclude part 12. Of Grand Canyon Oral History with Nancy Melody Meekum. Today is Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.